Good evening and welcome to another exciting episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. We have got a very interesting one for you this week. We're going to be focusing on monetization and microtransactions in the game industry. For those of you listening to this cast right now, it will probably be end of November, early December, but over the last few months, we have certainly seen a lot more pushes towards monetization in the AAA market, be it from titles like Shadows of War, Battlefront 2, Call of Duty, and the like. And joining me tonight is a video game economist who has talked about the subject at length many times on Gamma Sutra and around the game industry. Please welcome to the podcast, Ramin Shahrzad.
Thank you, Josh.
Hi, Ramin. It is a pleasure to have you on tonight. For those of you who don't know, Ramin has been a frequent post on Gamma Sutra, and that's kind of how we've met and spoke over the years.
I've also been pretty active on National Public Radio and media worldwide.
Awesome. I've been thinking about trying to get into like radio and stuff like that, but I just never really knew like how to approach that.
Well, basically they approach you is the way it happened for me.
Yeah, definitely some interesting things going on with Game Wisdom. After we're done with our little call, I'll tell you about some of the other things I have planned, because that will easily eat up like another 30 minutes, I think, and I'm sure we got a lot to discuss. So, to begin with, for the cast, or I mean, for people who don't know who you are, could you go over, I guess, a little bit about your background when it comes to the game industry?
Oh, wow. I mean, how far back do we want to go here? Because I'm pretty old, and I've been stacking a lot of different sciences and other things into what I do to get in order to be more effective at what I do. So, I mean, I could go all the way back to the Olympics if you want.
Let's, I think just to keep us from getting too long, I guess let's start with like in the last decade then, like in terms of how you really began in terms of researching and exploring like monetization and the economy when it comes to the game industry or game design.
Okay, well then, without going into detail, I'll just say that I have a very strong background in neuroscience, physiology, addiction research and clinical applications of drug rehab. And I was one of the first successful professional cyber athletes starting in 1999. I was so successful that I quit my day job. Mm-hmm. And I started writing about the trade of virtual goods in the Los Angeles Times in 2000. And began a pretty active gaming journalism career from 2001 to 2005. In 2005, with my high-altitude view of all this economic activity that was going on in games, I decided that the industry needed a dedicated game economist. This didn't exist at the time. And there was no theory about economics that was directly applicable to virtual economies. Mm-hmm. So I just went into seclusion, started developing this new research, went back to school, studied formal economics. And then in 2009, I completed that work and wrote some very extensive and still secret tomes, basically, on how to create frameworks for consumer-friendly game economies and monetization models, though we didn't actually start calling them monetization models until maybe 2011. Mm-hmm. And prior to that time, everything that I was working on was considered very theoretical, and people didn't really even know what to do with the research I was doing. Now, of course, it's a super hot topic, but mm-hmm. back then I was a little bit early and people didn't know why I was doing all the stuff I was doing. If you want to know about applications recently, I was the first game economist hired by Microsoft in 2012. I was hired as the first game economist by Wargaming in 2013, and I was able to apply my research to when I designed World of Tanks Blitz and World of Warships. Mm-hmm.
And that's very interesting, because I know that I have a few fans of mine who have looked at those games. I know for myself, I played World of Tanks, I think, probably, I think, like 2010, 2011. So this will probably been before you came on. And I remember what their monetization model was back then. I know, I think you made a post. I know there were articles about how things change with War Tanks Blitz. Sorry about that.
Are you asking me what the changes were?
No, I was just making a comment.
Okay.
Now, one thing that I just want to bring up that's just one of those like just very like serendipitous moments is that, Ramin, I think when we talked on Gamma Sutra, one of the first games that you really started to dive into in terms of virtual economies and such was Shattered Galaxy. I think that was back in 1999, 2000. And that was the first, like, I guess, like, full-fledged or MMO-style game that I had a chance to play. This was, again, it feels like a century ago, long before we started getting to these talks about MMO design.
Well, I didn't realize we were going to go back that far, but I love talking about Shattered Galaxy and even just that era around 2001, because I feel like that I like big games, and the bigger the better. And really, we really hit our peak as far as big games between 2001 and 2004, and it was all downhill since then, and I've been increasingly less impressed with what we produce today.
Yeah, and it's very interesting, again, about how the game industry has developed. At some point, I need to write a post or something about kind of like trying to track like these various like periods or ages when it comes to the game industry. But it's so weird to talk about that because what we consider to be the game industry is maybe at this point like 30, 32 years old in terms of when Nintendo kind of stepped back into it in 1985. But we have seen just some rapid advances over the last 30 years, and especially in the period you just mentioned, Ramin, 2001, 2004, that was kind of when things really started to accelerate in terms of standardization among design. We saw kind of the rise of Grand Theft Auto. Obviously, of course, World of Warcraft kind of like blew up the MMO market during that period as well.
Yes, and I see that as kind of the golden age of gaming. And the reason I would say it's been downhill since then is because we've kind of put the business of gaming ahead of the creativity of gaming, and we've made some choices around business model selection that have actually put the consumer second, and in doing so, we've made our games less and less entertaining over time.
And that is definitely a statement that's been shared by a lot of developers, especially as we've seen over the last, like, I would say the last, like, 7-8 years with this push towards the independent space, with a lot of developers getting fed up with the kind of forced design of AA, AAA development, and kind of getting back to making the games that they really want to make.
I think you'll hear the same feedback from consumers.
Yeah. Definitely. And that in of itself, I mean, that's an entire podcast topic right there about the rise of the independent scene. I mean, I am very sure between the two of us that if we're not careful, this could be like a 3-4 hour long podcast. So it is a good thing that you have a hard stop point today, Ramin, or who knows when we'll get done this talk.
Well, I'm trying to behave, but you know I can talk.
And for fans of Game Wisdom, you know we can get into some pretty big conversations. So fortunately, before we started this call, we kind of drew up a few points that we're going to try and focus on and try to keep on track the best we can. So I think keeping with this conversation about kind of the golden age of the industry and trying to figure out what happened, I think we can talk about our first point. And that is kind of trying to track this rise of monetization. Because as we were just saying on Skype chat a few minutes ago, what we would consider monetization started in like 2000, 2001, but it didn't really get the name until about 2011. And in that span or in that 10-year gap, we of course saw the MMO boom and crash. We saw the rise of smartphones and mobile and social games. And that whole thing. And you mentioned a few minutes ago, I mean, that you did research into the buying and selling of virtual goods, which obviously is a major factor of this rise of monetization and microtransactions.
Well, I mean, starting in 1999, I was making my living selling virtual goods.
Mm-hmm. And that's another one of those very weird things. Like, I was just talking to, again, for those of you listening, it'll probably be a few weeks, but for us right now, I was just talking to a few people, I think it was like a week or so ago, and we were seeing not only like with like the buying and selling of virtual goods, you know, stuff like Counter-Strike Go skins and stuff like that, but we actually found a website of people selling their services for raid play in Destiny 2. Like, you would pay these people to join you for a raid, and they will help you finish it. And this is one of those very strange things. And I think going back to what you said a few minutes ago, I mean, that in like the early thousands, or even for a good part of the last decade, a lot of this stuff no one was really thinking about. I remember like a few like exposés PC Gamer did about the rise of gold farmers in World of Warcraft. And I think that was like 2004, 2005. But there's definitely been, or there hasn't been, a lot of discussions about what it means to buy and sell virtual goods.
Well, I mean, you're talking about that type of behavior now, but in 1999, when I was the top cleric in a game called EverQuest, I had a service where if you wiped on a Fearplane raid, for instance, and you wanted me to come and get everyone out, because in EverQuest, if you died, your body stayed wherever it died, and if you didn't get it within 24 hours, you'd lose everything, and everything could be worth tens of thousands of dollars to you. People took this game pretty seriously, and my fee to come and recover a team was $300. Everyone knew this, so I was the recovery option of last resort, because that was the most expensive option. And if all of your friends came up and also died on the fear plane and their bodies were up there with you, then your last option was giving me a call. And I would get calls at 3 o'clock in the morning, and saying, okay, we need your help. And they would lift me up into the fear plane. I'd get everyone out, and they'd give me $300 worth of in-game gems, which I would then take to eBay and sell.
I have to say, as someone who thankfully like avoided a lot of the MMOs of like the last decade, that I am like chuckling on the inside to hear about how that kind of operate in the MMO space. But I know from looking at people, I know another big example would be games like World of Warcraft and EVE Online, that there is some major serious business. And as you just said, I mean, there is big money involved in these games. And that's the other very weird part about this. And this will probably be a good, another good point about our talk tonight, is putting a price tag on digital goods. Because as you're well aware, as much as I am, digital goods or virtual goods, there is no physical quantity to them. It's not the same as going to a manufacturer and printing up 100 new boxes or new shirts. Someone puts in a code or hits a key, and we can generate 50, 100,000 of these things. So how do you, and I think this may be too big to get into right now, but how do people put a price tag on these digital goods?
Well, let's use EVE Online as an example. Because by then I was getting fairly sophisticated with this, and it was a big market at that point. And in EVE Online, because I was a game economist helping CCP complete the design of their game economy, I actually knew the game economy really well. So when the game launched, I ended up being the richest player in EVE until I quit the game. And I would take half of my ISK and sell it on eBay, and then I would reinvest the other half of my ISK in order to generate more ISK. And so I was setting the prices for the real-world value of ISK in between the real-world economy and the game economy. And I was making $6,000 a month cash just playing EVE Online. And I was having a lot of fun. But I always used, just to be sure, I always used a shell account so that the money that was going through eBay couldn't be too easily tied directly to me, because you never know how the winds of change will blow and how that would go down. And by the time, and a year later, That was still technically legal in the game, but a year later, when World of Warcraft launched, they changed their end-user license agreement to make that type of behavior against the rules. Mm-hmm. Even though I had planned to do that with World of Warcraft, I chose not to because I want to stay on the right side of these companies that were also using me to help them build or repair their economies.
Now, I guess here is a question I'm kind of curious about. Where, I mean, when you get hired by a company of like Microsoft or Wargaming, like what kind of, I'm sure we can't get into too specifics due to NDAs, but like what is like your like general war? Like, you know, you don't have to get into specifics or anything NDA breaking, but when someone hires you to look at their economy system, what are they like expecting, or like what are you being hired to help them with?
Well, see, that's a really good question because I've been doing this so long, and instead of learning what's out there, I've been creating what's out there. So when a company hires me, they typically have no idea why they're hiring me. In fact, it generally takes months after they hire me to really understand the full scope of how I can help them. That was the case with Wargaming. After they hired me, they spent the first 3 months just trying to figure out what I do and wouldn't actually let me do anything for 3 months. And it was once they had figured out what I did, that's when they decided to have me do all the metagame design for all their games on three continents. So I was working on Blitz. I was working on World of Warships. Excuse me. I was working on the very large project that was going on in Wargaming Seattle, which was previously Gas-Powered Games. That's still top secret years later. And then I was also working on all the future second-generation mobile games for Wargaming, including some applications of the Master of Orion franchise, which is that IP is also owned by Wargaming.
Mm.
All this stuff that you may never see because I'm not there at Wargaming anymore.
Yeah, and what you just said like a second ago, I mean, that is just fascinating to me that the companies would hire you due to your reputation, your background, but they don't know exactly what to do with you. And it's one of those very like weird things about the game industry. I know, like for myself with Game Wisdom, that I talk about or I try to explore things from a design and mechanic standpoint. And like, I don't really see too many other people doing that exact same thing. Like, it's one of those very fascinating parts about the game industry is that there's still these facets of talking about that there really isn't, like a standard, or there really isn't, like, a usual approach for when we talk about it.
Well, I mean, there are certain circles in the industry that have standards, but I'm not part of those standards.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to get into, like, what Zynga or King or Machine Zone does, they've got that all down to a science. They've got the system. It's very predictable. They apply it to each new product. So you can see exactly what they're doing. It makes it very easy for me to reverse engineer and then report on what they're doing. But I don't report on what I'm doing. I just report on what they're doing. And what I do is still considered really an industry secret.
And I think that's a good segue into kind of moving our talk forward. Like, we started in the early thousands, of course, with MMOs and virtual goods. But obviously, one of the biggest changes and what kind of, I think, set us down this path of monetization came near the end of that decade, of course, with the free-to-play and mobile markets growing. Of course, you mentioned companies like King and Zynga, and I am sure anyone listening to this podcast right now knows some of the games that they've made. Stuff like Farmville and Clash of Clans have become almost like fixtures of popular culture these days. I mean, I'm still seeing commercials for Candy Crush Saga almost like at least like 3 to 4 times a week still.
Right. Well, as soon as you start throwing in Clash of Clans, you should mention Supercell, which is just a little bit different than those other three companies.
Yeah, definitely. And what we saw, I guess here's the question for you. I mean, again, like with your research and studying kind of or tracking this rise of monetization, what did you find when you started to look into these kinds of monetization models that started to pop up over the end of the last decade?
In 2009, for academic purposes, just to authenticate my work, because I thought I was going to go get a PhD and then teach the first generation of game economists, I wrote a 35-page paper that described the methodology for creating game economies and business models, which is what we now call these monetization models. Mm-hmm. So I described all the business models that were in existence and then proposed some new future ones, which we're now starting to see popping up, which is exciting to me because I'm just been waiting just from an academic perspective, yeah, to see when these new, you know, these new models would develop. Maybe I'm getting a little bit off your question. What was the original question?
When you start to look into the models for games like Farmville, Clash of Clans, and so on, what were your thoughts, or what kind of research did you pull out from examining these models in terms of what they were doing to their games, or just to due to the perception from the consumer?
Well, I mean, I chronicled all these methodologies back in 2009, but I never published that paper that was just shown to a few professors. So, as people are choosing these different models, I'm finding it interesting to see which choices they're making, because I know what their options are, and I see it fascinating, because when they choose one option or another, they're signaling that they've set certain priorities internally. And that's why they've chosen that model over perhaps another model.
And as we saw, and we'll be talking more about this idea of having or attempting to have ethical monetization or being a pro-consumer later on in this podcast. But as we've seen over the last decade, I think this will probably be where we'll move on to our next point. But to wrap up this one, over the last 3-4 years, probably even longer than that, we have certainly seen this push of monetization towards the AAA market. As I mentioned at the beginning of our cast, over the 2017, we've seen stuff like Shadows of War, Battlefront 2, and so on, of big-name AAA titles adapting these same monetization practices that we see out mobile and free-to-play games. And as you said at the start, Ramin, that things have certainly, and I know for a lot of people, share the same feeling that things have gone downhill in the AAA space over the last decade, just with a declining feeling of quality when it comes to these games.
Well, you have to realize that the people who run these companies are mostly people that have MBAs, mm-hmm, and an MBA is not a scientific degree. These aren't people generally that have science backgrounds. These are people that have business backgrounds.
Yes.
And businesses, basically, when you get an MBA, you're learning a methodology and you're learning a culture, but you're not learning a science. And so even though we like to think of ourselves as being very high tech as an industry, we're being dragged kicking and screaming into a more scientific view of game development. And to even know how to do game development scientifically, you have to know what a game does for a consumer and why a game is appealing to a consumer. And just those two concepts are basically just unknown to the gaming industry that is actually trying to make these products for consumers.
Mm-hmm. And I think you brought up a really good point there, about kind of the diverging backgrounds when it comes to the game development. And this is something that I've spoke about at length among indie developers. But there's a lot of people who feel that game design is being pulled between two masters. And of course, for those of you who are fans of Game Wisdom listening, you know what I'm about to say. It's the classic, the artist versus the businessman. And there are people out there who definitely lean towards one side or the other. And it's always tricky to try to talk about both in the same breath, because I've seen developers who, or as you just said, the people who run these publishers and major development studios like that definitely look at things from the side of business. But then on the independent side, we see many developers who just swear off of any kind of business practice or strategy. And it's sometimes very tricky to explain to someone that it's important, I think, to have a balance of both. Like, would you feel that same way, Ramin?
I would say that that's true, but it, coming from the business side of things, mm-hmm. there's this general thought that if you're good enough at business mm-hmm. and if you're good enough at marketing, you can take any product and sell it better by using more modern methods of marketing and maybe more modern methods of organization. And by organization, I mean, like, instead of paying a dollar for an employee in the USA, you can pay 20 mm-hmm. cents for an employee in Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. So learning how to get what you need at the lowest price and then sell it at the highest price is the way that they make a profit in business. And it, they don't really care what the product is because that's not really important to them.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I mean, we have seen many games come from the AAA space that have had low levels or not be up to the same quality standards as their peers by either cutting corners or, as a lot of gamers have certainly felt over the last few years, you know, rushing a game's development in order to then sell that stuff back as season passes and DLC down the line. And that actually takes me to a question that I am sure that someone will probably ask in the comments. But for you, Ramin, again, with your studies into the various monetization models, what do you think about the use or the implementation of season passes when it comes to AAA games today?
Would you like to define what you mean by a season pass?
Sure. A season pass for our conversation will be the developer essentially packaging up future or undeveloped content to then be sold to the consumer at a discounted price, with this content being available, or ideally being available, over the following month or a year after its release.
So you're saying, like, for instance, if I bought like a Founders Pack for Civilization and they agreed to give me the first four DLCs for free after I bought that, that's what you would consider a season pass?
I would say so. And also, if the developer just actually has a separate purchasing option saying, you can buy these DLCs as they're released, or you can give us money now and you'll get them at a slight discount when they're released, you know, who knows when.
Well, I mean, this is just basically an extension of the whole idea of like a Founders Pack where, you know, people are saying, if you give us all this money up front, then you'll get all this content down the road. But it only works if the consumer has a lot of confidence in the ability of the developer to provide quality future content. And that's, consumer confidence has been shaken as of late. So that's not as maybe easy to do as it used to be. Mm-hmm. And also, when you start talking about future downloads and DLCs for games, especially if they're multiplayer, we've gotten used to getting that for free.
Yes.
It's part of the reason why that's been free, other than maybe a subscription or some other way of paying, is that everybody needs to be running on the same rule set in the same world, mm-hmm. or things get really complicated. And if I've got all this content that you don't have, then how are we going to play together?
Yeah, you're not. And and it will lead to, as you just said, I mean, if it's stuff as small as, or I guess small in the general sense, like new weapons or items, it leads to an imbalanced game experience. But if we're talking about brand new content, as in new levels, maps, and so on, it can lead to just like mass confusion over the consumer as, you know, what do I need to play your game now?
Right. Well, I mean, this just goes back to a business philosophy where if you decide I'm going to inconvenience the consumer sufficiently, mm-hmm. then they will give me money.
Oh, yes, definitely. And I know we, not like in our last post, but I think like in, or I think late 2016 or early 2017, I know we talked about that kind of pay to annoy or pay to be less annoyed strategy that we've seen, especially out of the free to play and mobile games market.
Well, I mean, it isn't just unique to our industry. Yeah. If I have a cell phone and I don't pay it and it turns off, then I'm going to be really inconvenient. Then you'll be amazed how fast I can get down to the store to get that turned back on.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, of course. Or with a cable bill. You know, if you're watching your favorite game on TV and all of a sudden you get the pop-up saying this service has been turned off due to lack of payment, you're going to be calling up Comcast or Time Warner or anyone really fast.
Well, I mean, that just goes back to the fundamental concepts of capitalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, people don't love to work, but you can see people become very motivated to work when they don't have money for food.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Now, getting back to this point, I have two more questions for you, and then we'll move on to, I guess, like our next section. So the first one, keeping with this idea of, or kind of like tracking, like the history of monetization and DLC, one of the things I know, obviously with your background where you start with MMOs, during the late 90s, early 2000s, the popular model for earning money was obviously a subscription service. You know, $15 a month gets you in the game, and you can stay there for as long as you're paying that fee. And during the MMO rise of the early 2000s, that was kind of seen as the accepted model. But then when things crashed, a lot of MMOs, or shall I say everyone except for World of Warcraft, and maybe I think, I don't know, I guess a quick question here, I mean, does EVE Online still have a monthly subscription service?
They have Plex, which is how you use Plex to buy a subscription, and the subscription allows you to get accelerated learning on your character and some other benefits. And it's generally something you're going to need if you want to play successfully. You're going to need to have the subscription. But there's more than one way to purchase the subscription now.
Okay.
For instance, you can exchange your ISK instead of buying your ISK from me on eBay. You can turn things around and use your in-game currency and give the ISK back to CCP and then get a subscription for it. So in a way, you're doing what I was doing, except for instead of me making $6,000 a month, turning in my extra ISK. Instead, you're just not having to pay $15 a month or $10 a month for your subscription. So, but there's still, I mean, it's this real money transaction kind of thing. We're crossing over between virtual currencies and real currencies. And EVE Online, CCP, uses that as a way of controlling the economy so that there isn't too much ISK in the system. They're able to pull it out, act as a money sink by drawing the ISK out by allowing this type of exchange.
Hmm. That actually gives me another really good question. I want to come back to that in a minute before I forget my second question. But getting back to the first point, like I said, when it comes to the subscription model, we have seen almost the vast majority of MMO-based games shy away from that. So my question for you is, do you think, in terms of that as a viable financial model for games, do you think the subscription model service is pretty much like done, or do you think it's still possible for a developer to try and use that as their main form of revenue?
Well, I mean, you see a subscription model used by telecommunications companies to sell you service for your cell phone. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, one thing I predicted before it even became used in the telecommunications in my 2009 paper, because back in 2009, even the telecommunication companies weren't doing this, was that you would have more than one kind of subscription.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back to 2009, when I predicted that we would have layered or multiple tiers of subscriptions, the cell phone service was one price, all you can eat,
mm-hmm.
size fits all. And they found out that some people are willing to spend more than that. So they split it up, and they made it so the heavy users paid more and the light users paid less. And by doing this, they were able to make a lot more money. And it was perceived as fair by consumers because the heavy users should pay more. So this is something that was a change made in telecommunications. It was a change in monetization. It was adopted very readily by consumers. And for some reason, it hasn't really happened yet in the gaming industry.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, like I see it with like cable service as well. You don't. It's not just you paying one service to get all the channels. There's, at least I know with Comcast, like 3 or 4 different tiers of cable packages, along with 3 to 4 different tiers of internet services. And that's probably a whole discussion in of itself right there.
Right. So instead of just making it these tiers, which are very easy to understand, very transparent, the gaming industry has gone down this kind of a mysterious, kind of sneaky, let's kind of trick people out of money pathway, which is much less transparent. And I think if you saw the type of like casino-like methods that we use in gaming now, if the telecommunications companies use those, like if you had to open up a gotcha box and see how much service you were going to get on your phone, I think that you'd see a consumer revolt, which I think maybe we're going to see a consumer revolt in gaming too. It's just taking a little longer to develop.
Mm-hmm. And that actually is a perfect segue into the second question I have for you, Ramin. And that is talking about what's become, I guess, commonly known as games as a service. It's a, of course, a very popular term these days to describe games that are being developed with the idea of continued and consistent support and content way beyond the release of the game. And again, when we talk about the AAA market, this has become a major fixture of it, with the idea of DLC, microtransactions, more maps, more purchases, and so on and so forth. And I guess for you, with the research that you've done, I guess, what do you think, or what is happening with developers embracing this games as a service model when it comes to developing their game?
Well, my 2009 paper predicted games as a service would be a certainty. There was nothing ambiguous about this. It was absolutely where we were going to go. It was just a matter of how we were going to deploy it. So that's why I was building frameworks for that, because this all had to be developed by someone in order for it to be implemented. But in industry now, for some reason, we don't hire people to do that. Instead, we just look to see what someone else has done and we try to copy it, which is like the least scientific method of doing something. And it means there's a really long delay between when something becomes created and when it actually becomes deployed. So right now, if you see something successful come out of, say, a small company like Supercell, and I say small because numerically, they don't have a lot of employees. But when they do something and it's successful, then it's adopted by the much larger companies, which could have done that first if they had had employees qualified to do that sort of thing. But they don't do that. They don't even add employees. Like, you know, in order in a company to be employed for something, a job description has to be created.
And
job description is only created after that job has existed maybe in 100 other places. They think, oh, well, we need one now too. So for instance, like Blizzard just hired their first game economist, or at least someone with the title game economist. And that was 2009 is when I recommended they do that. So it took them 8 years. That's the delay. And the larger the company, the longer the delay between something when something is invented and when something is actually deployed.
Oh, yes. And we've certainly seen that, especially with the rise of games as a service over the last 6-7 years. That, as you just said, I mean, that once someone develops and becomes popular, it then kind of, you know, flows out to other developers. I mean, we could say kind of how microtransactions and monetization along that side have now started to bubble up into the AAA space. I mean, we can certainly point to stuff like, again, Shadow of War, Battlefront 2, that are now embracing these same strategies that once started out just on the free-to-play side.
Well, I mean, if you type into a search for some either the word clash or the word clan.
Oh, yes.
Like, over 100 things will pop up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's trying to copy what they perceive as working. But the problem is, the more people copy something, you approach something we call in economics called perfect competition. The first person in with something innovative that meets the needs of consumers makes all the money.
Oh, yes.
Same thing happened with World of Tanks. They made enough money to go from 40 employees to 4,000 employees in just 2 years. And I was hired at the tail end of that.
The same thing with World of Warcraft as well, when it kind of blew up in the early thousands.
Right, and these companies became huge. And then once they're huge, if they just keep doing the same thing, then they're no longer innovating. Mm-hmm. And that's when they start to see layoffs, because they've bloated, but they can't justify the bloat after a while.
Mm-hmm. And when everyone else starts trying to copy it, it becomes a case, and the same thing we saw with the MMO crash, that everyone's trying to be the next World of Warcraft. But why should the consumer play your game when they still have World of Warcraft, you know, sitting right there on their desktop?
Exactly. They're already familiar with that. So once a company is in first with something like that, they get the market share. It's very difficult to grab that market share by just doing the same thing. You have to do something better. And if you're trying to copy someone, you can't do it better. The best you can do is just do it as good as what you're copying.
Oh, yes. And oh my goodness, there are so many examples we could jump off or segue into. But getting back to what you were saying a few minutes ago, I mean, there's one, I guess, somewhat of a tangent that I wanted to ask you about. And this is one of those things that, like, for myself and I think for the general consumer, it still sounds very strange. And that is the idea of having a limit on virtual currency. As you said with EVE Online, and there, I think it was ISK you said, that they do stuff like having a money sink in order to regulate or control how much of that currency is available on the market. The same thing, or something similar, I guess, would be Blizzard cracking down on gold farmers and trying to control that. And my question for you is, like, as like from a general consumer standpoint, why is there a need for regulation or control over a virtual currency? Given by the fact that for a lot of people, we're still thinking of it as the same way as it's something that should be infinite, considering that there is no physical quantity or physical construction for it.
I can answer your question, but your question is actually pretty large, and it could take quite a while to answer it really properly. But let me just go back a little bit in time to the start of World of Warcraft. In World of Warcraft, I was really hooked on World of Warcraft. I ended up eventually, after one year, I had 12 max level, max crafting characters on 4 servers. And of course, I was also, you know, had a good relationship with the developers. And it was, you know, helping them develop beta test things and stuff. Even I was in World of Warcraft all the way back in the alpha. Mm-hmm. And when I saw the gold farmers come in, which is something I had predicted in a LA Times article in April of 2000, when the gold farmers came in and started mass producing these economic elements and then selling them to players, that lowered the value of all these economic elements, because as soon as they became no longer scarce, then they were no longer of any particular use. Mm-hmm. So this actually caused these economies to collapse. It flooded them, and it made the existing content useless. In order to make anything useful for the players to play around with, Blizzard had to go back and make new content, which was expensive for them. Mm-hmm. So I looked at this all going on as a game journalist at the time, and also as an economy designer even back then, and I said, this is catastrophic. And I thought, there's got to be a solution. And Blizzard's solution at the time was what I call active defenses. They wanted to go in, identify the offenders, these gold farmers, and neutralize them. But that type of reactive or active defense is not only very expensive, but you also get false positives, because your top players are also very productive and play a lot and are going to look like gold farmers. So you end up eliminating your best players while trying to get rid of the gold farmers. My approach, which is apparently still novel, is that I want to look at how is the economy itself designed that's promoting these gold farmers. And I end up, between 2005 and late 2009, I was hoping I could do this in 1 year, but it took me 4.5 years. My goal was to create a new economic model that was resistant, that was completely resistant to attack by gold farmers, such that gold farmers just would give up and you wouldn't have to lift a finger in order to prevent this type of activity. And I really thought I could do this in a year. I was being a little bit naive. It took me 4.5 years. But as far as I know, I'm the only one who's ever done it. But now that technology is no longer needed by industry because they became so convinced that making large worlds like that doesn't work anymore, that they've basically just stopped investing in them.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need a technology for something you're no longer planning on building.
Nope. And we've seen, like, as you just said, I mean, that the MMO space has really dried up in that sense of those big worlds. I mean, I grew up, I think, I was watching the same way as you were in the early thousands with these just massive game spaces for people to explore. And it kind of feels like things have segued into this, I guess, this new subgenre, like the open world survival game with stuff like Rust, Ark, and I'm sure there's probably a few half dozen more that I'm forgetting right now.
Well, if you go back to Shattered Galaxy in 2000, it actually released in 2001. We beat Lineage to Market by 3 months, so I kind of consider it the first real big Asian game to be localized, first big Asian MMO to be localized in the American or English speaking space. And we had 15-on-15 battles real time, which with each person able to control up to 12 individually unique units simultaneously, and they were able to swap those units out and bring in another set, 12 every minute and a half. So you were literally talking about battles with thousands of units versus thousands of units in that space in a 15-minute battle in 2001.
Yeah.
And the closest thing we have to that now is World of Tanks. But even World of Tanks, that's just one unit per person. So the complexity has gone down dramatically since 2001. And that complexity has gone down not because our technology has gone down since 2001, not because our ability to host that many people simultaneously has gone down, but it's gone down because we don't know from a business standpoint or from a design standpoint how to handle that many players without running into problems. And so instead of solving the problems, we just decide, let's do something else.
Yeah.
And here I am, though, as having been working on Shattered Galaxy, trying to solve those problems because I want games with 100-on-100 battles. I want to get in and just, I mean, and I don't mean just having one person running around with a gun shooting somebody else with a gun. I mean, like, full virtual reality type of worlds where you might have hundreds of ships versus hundreds of ships, like you have in Eve. Mm-hmm. And Eve could have done this, but again, they didn't, because the way their economy was set up, if you lost your ship, it was game over.
Yeah.
You didn't get it back. It was a permanent loss. Well, I think that's unfortunate, because the best part of EVE Online is when you get these huge battles. I organized the first large battle in EVE Online with capital ships. And on my side, there was only one battleship. It was mine. On the other side, there were officially nine battleships, and then a pirate with a battleship came in, making it 10-on-1. Our side actually won, but that's a whole other story.
Oh, yes.
But because we had set this up, we had planned on this happening this way. But that was just an epic battle. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was interviewed about the early times recently of what EVE was like, and I was talking about this battle, and it was just crazy. And those were such good times. I still remember them, even though that was 14 years ago. And there's just nothing like that now in gaming. Mm-hmm. The people in EVE are afraid to use their big ships because they might lose them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. It doesn't have to be that way.
I know. And like, going back to Shattered Galaxy, that was the first, like I said, that was my first real exposure to MMOs. And as you said, I mean, that was kind of like the first case of a Chinese-based publisher, Chinese-based MMO coming over to the United States. I mean, name Nexon, I know today, Korean. I think lot of people know who they are.
They're Korean.
I'm sorry, Korean.
Now they're technically Japanese because they like incorporated in Japan.
Yep. But I remember I played like another one from them. I think it was like Albatross 18. It was like a free-to-play miniature golf game or arcade golf game. And but getting back to Shadow Galaxy, that was the first game that I played that I actually bought like the year subscription for it. So I actually was playing that game for an entire year. I think that is the record for me of playing an MMO, because I only got about, I think, 4 or 5 months out of World of Warcraft. And again, we're talking 2004, so year one. And I just pretty much like lost interest in that. But again, that's another 20, 30 minute talk right there. But we have 4 other points to get to, and hopefully we can get to them today. But I think we do. I do want to at least touch on a few of these, and hopefully see how far we can get. And the
I just want to mention that Shattered Galaxy, when it failed, the rest of the industry looked at it and said, "Oh, that failed because there isn't enough consumer demand for this product." Mm. That's not true at all. There was massive consumer demand for Shattered Galaxy, and there still is. You see it in World of Warcraft. I mean, I'm sorry, World of Tanks. Mm-hmm. Same consumer demand. Hugely successful. Yep. This type of multiple team of large team on large team is hugely in demand. But it failed for some very interesting reasons that I don't think have really ever been put into the public space.
We were talking about the idea of infinite game value, because I know that I messed up on the term when I brought up in an industry insight. So I figure this will be a good time for people who are listening who may have saw my video or because of the fact that I messed up on it. What do you mean by the term infinite game value when it comes to this kind of game design or monetization?
Even in the real world, $1 million is not worth 10 times as much to a person as $100,000 is. Mm-hmm. Mathematically, it's worth 10 times more. But actually, it isn't to a person, because we know that once you have like $70,000 as far as like income a year, mm-hmm. that's enough to make you happy. And any dollars above $70,000, and here I'm talking life in the West, you could live just comfortably for much less maybe in another country. But additional dollars above that give less and less value. There's diminishing returns because your basic needs are met.
Yeah.
So anything else is just luxury. And luxury isn't really worth as much as just the essentials like housing and healthcare and food and some basic ability to travel. So in a game, if we can convince you that $1 million is worth 10 times as much as $100,000, and part of your brain wants to believe this, then we can do a bunch of things to you. We can get really tricky. For instance, if I come into a game and I'm told that 1,000 units of premium currency is worth $5, mm-hmm. and this is shown to me several times in just the first few hours of play, I become comfortable with that idea that that amount of currency has a real world value of $5. But really, it could have any value. It's just whatever they say it is, but yep. that doesn't mean it really has any value to you at all. Because if I spend a thousand premium currency, do I get any more content for that? No. Mm-hmm. Does my play experience get any better? Not really. I mean, it's the same game no matter how much I spend. So really, this premium currency has a value very close to zero. But if we can be convinced that some amount has a fixed value, then they can turn around and say, okay, now I'm going to give you a special offer where I'm going to discount this by 95%. And then your brain explodes and goes, oh my God, 95% off. This is unheard of. This is crazy. I mean, it couldn't hurt to spend $5 now and get $100 worth of premium currency. I'll be set. I mean, I won't have to spend any money again and I'll be a big deal, et cetera, et cetera. But as soon as you do that, you've been marked as a spender. The game adjusts in difficulty so that now it's just as hard or even harder than it was before. And you'll get another offer where now instead of getting a 95% discount, you get a 99% discount. And your brain explodes again and goes, oh my God. So now you're spending $10 to get, but instead of getting twice as much, you're getting 10 times as much as you did before. And once you fall for that, now you're going to get an offer of like 99.5% discount. And you're like, dang, this is almost free. But The thing is, it's not free because the price is actually going up each time. It's just you're getting so much more. And you're thinking, you're getting, oh, I'm getting 100 times more premium currency, so I'm getting 100 times more value. But really, if you stop and think about it, the game didn't get any better after you bought that. So the value, your brain mathematically wants to think that something that's 10 times bigger is 10 times better. But 10 times zero is still zero. So if you can be convinced that that premium currency had value in the beginning, then they can just ride you forever. And there are games like this that use this model that people have spent up to $30 million on them individually, one person. Mm. So and somebody who's vulnerable to this type of thinking is extremely valuable to these companies. So while a normal user acquisition, you know, pay for an install could be $3 to $7. If they can figure out a way to target these vulnerable people, they're willing to pay $63 per install for these people. And fortunately, we now have the technology to figure out who these people are in advance. So we can actually target these people, spend almost $100 to get them to install the game because we know they will fall for this trick and end up spending more than $100.
Mm. Yeah, and as we talked about, one of the things that's very dangerous is the fact, as you just said, Ramin, that this is a case of a company not only creating the currency, but they're also dictating what you can spend on, what things cost. As you said, someone buys 1,000 points of premium currency, you think, oh my goodness, I can do so much with that. But who's to say the developer will now say, oh, well, if you won this super great advantage, it costs 2,000 points of premium currency, so you have to buy more. And they can just keep scaling this up. And we have seen this time and time again in the free-to-play or mobile space of how these costs continue to escalate the further you get into the game. And as we said earlier, it becomes essentially pay to be less annoying when you're just constantly having to put money in to make the same progress that you did for less earlier in the game space.
But the game doesn't get less annoying. In fact, the more you spend, the more annoying it gets. And since you're already invested, you have to spend more to cover what you've already invested.
Mm-hmm. And I guess
not every game is built like this, but the games that are designed to use this infinite value trick have actually no cap as to how powerful you can get in the game. There's the game is the progression system is literally infinite.
Mm-hmm.
So you could go on forever and just keep buying and keep getting more powerful. But the game will then pit you against other players that have spent as much as you. And so your net difficulty level hasn't changed at all. No. And if that was what you thought you were going to get, an easier game by spending, you didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing even in Clash Royale, where people will spend to get more boxes opened up in order to get more stuff. But then the matchmaker just pits you against people who did the same thing as you. And so there's no advantage. And so... Mm-hmm. But as long as your brain's telling you you're getting something, you're going to spend until you figure out the trick, which could take you a while. And the longer it takes you, the more money they get out of you. Mm-hmm. And that's why these games are particularly effective when they're marketed towards children. And you can see when they're marketed towards children because you can see by the graphics
that they
use Comic Sans because they're wanting the game to be attractive to children. These games get very upset with me when I talk about this, and I get calls from lawyers, and I've actually described some of those conversations on Gamma Sutra before when the lawyers call. But the basic of it is they are making games that are attracted to children. Children are the most vulnerable group for using these games. There was a secret EDAR report. EDAR is E-E. DAR, it's the number one industry statistical tracking service, mm-hmm. that they found that up to 50% of whales in games are children. Mm. And after they came to that conclusion, it was amazing how fast that report disappeared. It was never published because EDAR is paid by industry. Mm-hmm. They're not going to publish that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if those numbers have changed over time, but you can see that the industry is conscious of this, that children will hit the green button rather than the red button because mm-hmm. green is safe. And green is always the button that makes you spend.
Oh, yeah.
So And that's not an accident. I showed when I was called by regulars in 2013 to explain to them what we were doing to children. I showed them just game after game where all the buttons you spend on are green, and children just may not even be able to read what's on the button, but they know they're supposed to hit the green button. So they do.
Yeah.
And then the parents get the bill, and then Apple, instead of saying, yeah, you're right, we shouldn't have charged these children, took them to court and they had to do a class action. And that was brutal for them. I mean, Apple just did not want to refund money spent by children.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is stacked against the consumer.
Oh, yes. And what you were saying a few minutes ago regarding the matchmaking of putting people who spend money against people who also spend money, but that has become a major part of competitive-based titles when you're trying to get these people to essentially – you know, bid up on their game. Oh, I bought this weapon that gives me 50 points of damage. Well, this guy bought a weapon that does 52 points of damage. So now I have to spend more money to compete with them. And it repeats again and again and again. And I also want to clarify,
Before you get off, I want to just point out that when we come to matchmakers, we just found out recently that Activision filed for a patent in order to have a system where their matchmaker intentionally pits you against somebody who's way out of your league, even while you're in the ladder system, in order to make you lose but want to try to buy the cards that you were just beaten by. And they felt that this was such an amazingly good technique to put in their game that they patented it. They thought it was really clever. And I identified this back in 2015 when I saw an anomaly in their matchmaker, but I couldn't figure out whether they just didn't know how to make a matchmaker or if they were up to something. And so I couldn't confirm it until I saw the patent. But you can see here that these matchmakers, which you think are there to create a fair contest to improve gameplay, to make the game enjoyable for the consumer, there's all kinds of tricks going on now where everything you think that's fair isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Even the gacha boxes you're opening up, a lot of times they're not random.
Oh, yes. Going back to, like as you said, like with these kind of tricks when someone starts playing a game, you notice how in the vast majority of gacha-based mobile or free-to-play games, that one of the first things they want you to do is they're going to give you a premium or regular gacha box open for free. And it just so happens that box will have something that's rare, or if it's like a 1 to 5 star system, they'll give you like a 3 to 4 star character right at the get-go. And again, it tricks the person thinking, oh my goodness, if I got this super rare character on my very first box, well, surely I should spend more money and buy 5 more of these boxes or 10 more.
Right, because humans are prone to using inductive reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Inductive reasoning is, if something happened the same way the last 10 times, then we just assume it's going to happen the same way on the 11th time.
Mm-hmm.
Inductive reasoning is actually quite useful. I mean, if I know that I can drive through a green light without getting hit, and it's worked the last 1,000 times, then on the 1,000th of the one time, I'm just going to drive through the green light and not have to stop at the green light just to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
Because if everybody had to stop at the green light just to be safe, it wouldn't work. So it normally works, except for when it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
But here, we know that we can trick humans because they're going to think, oh, well, if they got a 3-star on the last box, they're going to think they're going to get a 3-star on the next box.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the point I wanted to touch on, a few minutes ago you mentioned, of course, about how the pay button in these games is always green, because green is considered like a safe color. It's very easy for someone to look at that and go, oh, green is go, green is good. And one of the things that, and this could easily be its own conversation of itself, is that a lot of the monetization aspects or the tricks that people use is really just trying to figure out the most optimized or the best way to design these games. And this actually goes back to what you were saying earlier, Ramin, that a lot of the stuff that we've seen, you know, DLC, games as a service, used to be free elements. They were just a part of the standard package of playing these games. And it's the same thing with these affordances to try and motivate you to spend money. This was just simply used to make an attractive and easy to follow UI for a game. And it's really been, you know, changed and altered to try and maximize profit.
When you go to your phone company and you say, I'm going to spend an extra $10 a month to get twice as much service, then I'm getting more service. Mm-hmm. I'm getting more content for my money. When I go into a game and I buy a DLC, at least in a single player game, to get more content so I can extend the play value of my game, I'm getting more value for my money. But what's increasingly happening in the gaming industry is not any of those situations I just described. Mm-hmm. What instead is happening is we're trying to trick people into spending without giving them any more content or any more value. Mm-hmm. And this is what's happening is basically we're raising the cost of games and while simultaneously lowering the value of games. So basically, games are a much weaker investment for your entertainment dollar than they used to be. They used to be a huge value. Now they're not. So people are starting to move back away from gaming into other things. And it's really hurting. It's causing layoffs all across the industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you said, like when it comes to like this kind of infinite game value, you're trying to condition people to spend money. You mentioned, of course, of like the $99.95 bundles that seems has become the standard for a lot of these games. And in each one of the games that I've looked at over the last like 2 months, I finally got my hands on a smartphone, so I've had a chance to now see this firsthand. Each and every one of those purchases does not give me anything. It gives me resources. It gives me gacha boxes. But again, where is the value in that? The answer is that there isn't. Having, 100 gacha boxes doesn't make me 100 times a better player. It gives me 100 chances to maybe get better, but obviously that's not really going to happen. Because I've seen, these like 5-star drop chances, 1% or 0.5%. So how much are you really spending and how much of that is actually moving you forward?
Well, this whole idea of even moving forward is kind of tricky because basically if you have characters in a game that are of a certain strength, you will advance until you get to the point where that's not strong enough.
Yes.
So if you are thinking, oh, well, I'm stuck. I need more strength. I'm going to buy it. Well, then sure, you jump up, you pass a little bit of the content, and now you're stuck again. Mm-hmm. Your situation hasn't changed at all, and you haven't earned anything. You just bought something. So the only thing you've accomplished is you have less money now.
Yeah. Oh, yes, definitely. I was looking at a loot box-based game the other night that my party right now is all made up of, I think, like 6-star and like 5-star characters, which it sounds very impressive. Until you realize that I can't move forward at all in progress or even play PvP because apparently there's also 7, 8, 9-star ranks. And as you said earlier, as long as there are numbers in the universe, you can keep scaling this up. Who's to say that in a year from now, the developer will say, hey, let's add stars 10 through 15 as our new cap. And we'll, raise the power curve that way. And it just keeps going and going.
And each new star costs 10 times more than the previous star.
Of course.
And that's why pretty soon you might have people spending millions of dollars. At least that's what the developer is hoping. Mm-hmm. But these people, but even at that point, they're not getting any better play experience. It's just the same game.
Oh, yeah. And it's just, again, being scaled. It's the same thing we actually saw going quickly back to MMOs. It's how the progression curve works. When you start playing an MMO, you're not fighting dragons and overlords and giant monsters. You're fighting rats and, very basic thieves. But then, of course, over the length of the game, things start to scale up. Now you're fighting werewolves, and then you're fighting captains, and of course by the end when we're talking raid level content, you're fighting these epic legendary creatures, and it's all designed to make you feel like, look how far you've come, look how much you've grown over the last 20 to 50 hours, but in all actuality, you're still, the gameplay still remains the same, it's just how the numbers have differed.
Well, yes, but I feel bad for today's gamers because mm-hmm. when you go back to that golden era between 2001 and 2004, it wasn't about how big the creature was you're fighting. Mm-hmm. It was about the social interaction with all the people you're playing with. And these games started to get really large where you would have 500 people interacting simultaneously in one area where they might be fighting over a big dragon or something. And, you know, one team's trying to defeat the dragon, another one's trying to come in and stop them from defeating the dragon. And, you know, and you knew all these people because you were playing with these people months or years. So this social interaction was where it was really at. And when the gold farmers came in and started preying on these economies, instead of following the approach that I approached, which was to create a passive defense just to get rid of the gold farmers, instead they decided that the economy itself, if it was going to collapse, was the threat, and the economy was the glue that brought people together. It made them useful. So by killing the economy, they also killed the social interaction. Because now, who cares if I'm good at collecting this or that? I can't trade it with anyone. If I want something, the only person I can trade with now is the developer through these microtransactions. So they took complete control of the economies. Basically, they destroyed their own economies so that they could sell them off themselves. Mm-hmm. And this killed the social interaction. So the social interaction in modern games is just a sliver of what it was 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that's a shame, because that's what really people come together in games to enjoy, is the social interaction. It's not, oh, I'm now fighting a 3-star creature instead of a 2-star creature.
Mm-hmm. I think for our last point, hopefully this won't be a long one, but this is what I want to use to kind of put a cap on our discussion. And that is a discussion over the idea of ethical monetization, or pro-consumer versions of what we've talked about. Now, obviously, over the course of the last, it feels like we just started. We're almost at an hour and 20 in.
I know, really. Feels like 5 minutes.
I know. Over the course of our little chat, we have talked about things from the anti-consumer aspect. Again, tactics and strategies that have been used to manipulate people into spending money. And as I'm sure you're as aware of as I am, there have been many conversations, presentations, and just rooms of people who have discussed the best ways of tricking people into spending money. But we've also been seeing attempts at trying to do things from, you know, the moral high ground, games that aren't trying to manipulate people into spending money. So my question for you, again, this could probably be an entire hour right here, but when we talk about games that are doing this on the up and up, I guess, what are some examples, even if we can't think of anything from like specific games, but what qualities, I guess, make up like an ethical monetization model?
Okay, well, before I forget, I just want to thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you. Because I'm
not only a consumer advocate, but I'm also an industry advocate, because I want industry to be able to make more money so that they can make better games, so that I can play them. Mm-hmm. But increasingly, as I've been trying to advise industry on how to do this, taking the high ground, increasingly I feel like I'm getting censored. So it's great to be able to come on here where I know you're not paid by the industry. So you can give your consumers, the gamers, the listeners, the information they want, and know that no one's going to stop you. And I like that. So that I'm glad you gave me a chance to come here and do that with you. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you want some examples of like ethical monetization.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. Well, of course, I'm going to point to my models first, because that's how I design them. So if you look at, for instance, World of Tanks Blitz, I was hired by Wargaming because we had a similar philosophy as far as what consumers wanted. They wanted to have fair battles where they can compete in esports and feel like at the end, when they had won, it was because of their merits. And so when you see a battle in World of Tanks, 15 on 15, they work very hard to make sure those battles are fair. You may have a smaller tank in one battle, but then you'll have a bigger tank in another battle. And it's fair because your team is balanced with the other team, because you have a fair matchmaker, as opposed to like what Activision patented recently, where they intentionally wanted to create unfair matchmaking. So that's an example of fair, but there was also this thing about like premium ammo. Premium ammo was a way to make it a little bit unfair for you. Mm-hmm. And so when I made Blitz, I tried very hard to get premium ammo removed. I did a bunch of other things to make the game more fair. But still, when you play a World of Tanks Blitz, you feel like you're winning based on your merits, with the possible exception of the premium ammo. And then by the time I was on the team building World of Warships, I had enough influence in the company that I was able to get premium ammo completely removed from the game. This was really not easy to do, because a lot of people had already, you know, become very attached to premium ammunition. Mm-hmm. It was a relatively small but significant pay-to-win mechanism. Yeah. And if you lost in a battle before, and you're like, oh well, I lost, but it's because the other guy used premium ammo. Well, you don't know that they used premium ammo, but you're always going to assume they did if they could have. And so it's always like a way of blaming someone else for your loss. Oh, I was premium ammo. But as soon as you remove that, then everyone knows the game is fair, and that makes such a big difference.
Yeah, and so,
that's why World of Warships, even more so than World of Tanks, has massively effective monetization numbers. It's crazy how much money that game makes, because we're giving the consumer what they want, and ultimately that's what they're paying for.
Mm-hmm. And as a quick aside of that, I want to go back to what you said earlier regarding inductive reasoning. It's that same element we saw in games like built around probability, that if someone associates that if I have an 8% chance to hit and I hit every time, then I know that, then I expect that to happen each and every way. And when it doesn't, the person feels like the game is cheating, or the game is, you know, against them. And it's the very same kind of principle what you just described, Raymond, that when someone sees a game like World Tanks, or they see any game with a optional microtransaction that gives power, even if it's not a factor in that specific match, they're going to assume that, oh, I didn't lose because, you know, this person was better than me. I lost because they had, or they bought this extra advantage. So the game must be rigged against me.
And that makes people unhappy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And they don't play a game to become unhappy. I wish I could explain this to the leaders of our major game companies, but that's not why people play games. They don't want to play to be unhappy.
Mm-mm. If you put too many barriers in front of the player to annoy them or try to convince them to spend money, you're going to do the opposite. You're going to push them away.
But the leaders of almost every major gaming company do not understand this. They think the more uncomfortable you make a person, the more they will spend.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not gamers. They don't understand. It's very hard to explain this to them.
Yep. And it's one of the major issues. And as we said earlier, when one of these industry heads see a game like Clash of Clans, or they see Farmville, or they see these big dollar signs thrown about how much money they're making, they're going to try and adopt them for themselves. We mentioned, of course, loot boxes being a big point. I mean, this year we've seen at least three that I can think of off the top of my head, three AAA games embrace
Clash of Clans. Mm-hmm. Clash of Clans is a great example.
Yeah.
Because other game company leaders look at Clash of Clans and they say, oh, look, they inconvenienced their players constantly, and then they made a lot of money. So that must be what we should do too. But see, Clash of Clans was a reskin of a Facebook game called Backyard Monsters from 3 years previously. Almost identical, just as reskinned. But the one difference is that Clash of Clans had minor social interaction opportunities, whereas Backyard Monsters had no social interaction opportunities. And even just a little bit of social interaction, consumers are so desperate for it that they'll pay a lot of money for that. So that made that game a huge hit. But because it was just a subtle difference, mm-hmm. That's not what the other companies noticed. They noticed, oh, they're making these incredibly long timers, and
yes,
you have to pay for resources and all these things to inconvenience players. They thought, oh, that's the difference that they noticed, because at their education level, that's the only part that was visible to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they end up following the wrong inputs and making decisions that were erroneous. And now the whole industry is going in an erroneous path because they had a background in business, but not in science or even mathematics. So yeah, they didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah. And as one other very special side about this whole idea of pay to be less annoying, I also want to bring up the fact that one of the things that has driven me nuts about a lot of the mobile games I've downloaded is that they all basically hijack my alarm to buzz me when a loot box needs to be opened. So I have one game that I installed the other night, I think it was from Nexon too, that it buzzed my phone at 3 o'clock in the morning and then at 3:40 in the morning to say, hey, your loot box is ready to be opened right now. And I was like, you know what? No, I'm done with this.
Step one, install. Step two, turn off notifications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Step three might be uninstall if it gets any worse than that.
I thought I did turn off those notifications, so I don't know what it must have had a mind of its own with that buzz. And I was like, you know what? No, if it's annoying, you know. And actually, this is a perfect way to bring back in our conversation. If it's annoying 5 minutes into playing into this game or one day, I'm not going to keep it on for, you know, 50 days or 100 days.
Right. And if in the first 5 minutes I get shown an ad that tells me I can get $400 mm-hmm. value for $20, then I'm thinking, wow, this game really costs $400 to play. I mean, I could download like a really nice AAA game for $60. Why would I really want to value your junk mm-hmm. for $400?
Yeah. And now we're seeing that same kind of push being towards AAA games, where you're spending $60 on the game, and then they throw you a $99 purchase on top of that, that supposedly is the best value for buying premium currency.
Right. Well, if you just saw 2K Games mm-hmm. and Ubisoft and a bunch of other companies are just now coming out with their reports and saying that they're making more money on these add-ons than they are from selling the game in the first. So what that really tells you is if the game is $60, the real cost to play is more than $120.
Mm-hmm. And going back to what you said a few minutes ago regarding the player's perception, when you hear developers try and, you know, do the mental jumping through mental hoops about, oh, our game wasn't bounced around loot boxes or gacha design like they did with Shadows of War. Even if that may be true, which I don't think it is true with Shadows of War.
I doubt it. Unlikely.
Yeah, definitely not. But you have the consumer, if there's any issue while they're playing that game, even if it isn't related to these loot boxes, they're going to put in their mind saying, this is just a game saying, oh, you need to spend $10 here or $20 here in order to get further, and it's going to push them away from it.
And who's most likely to open the box?
Children again.
You got it.
Mm-hmm. But it is, I know we're going on 4 o'clock now, and there's still so much to talk about. But, I mean, it has been an absolute pleasure talking with you, and we definitely need to do this again soon. Maybe even a live cast before this one goes up, because there's still so much we haven't touched on yet.
Yeah, that would be great. And we, you know, if we know we're going to do another, we can always drill down on a particular topic and go into more depth because, you know, we're just going over the surface here. But this rabbit hole goes really deep, Josh.
I know, definitely. But we are going to wrap things up for today. Again, this will most likely be part one of who knows how many more talks. But again, I mean, it has been great hanging out with you. Like I said at the start, we've been talking through chat and Gamasutra message boards or posting comments for the last few years now. But this is the first time we've actually had a chance to talk vocally with each other. And it has been great.
I enjoyed it, Josh. Let's do it again.
Me too. All right. So for those of you listening, again, I'm sure you probably have a lot of questions for Ramin and myself as well, but we will have to wrap it up for today. So thank you so much for listening. If you would like to support Game Wisdom and what I do, we have several options available. You can follow me on Twitter at GWBicer for thoughts throughout the day, as well as updates on posts. If you'd like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted. For my daily videos and discussions on design, check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. And last but not least, if you like support through Patreon, patreon.com/GWBicer. A dollar or more will get you into our private Discord channel where we talk design topics and whatnot. $5 or more will get you VIP status for voting on specific Patreon-funded events. But again, I will let you go for tonight, Ramin. So thank you so much for coming on. Be sure to pick up your child. I don't want you to get in any more trouble with that. And we will definitely talk again in the future. So with that said, thanks so much for listening. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.